you enjoy Coffeehouse Shots from The Spectator, then why not check out Spectator TV? Every Thursday night, Andrew Neil and a collection of guests, as well as The Spectator's home team, bring you analysis on the latest developments in current affairs, coronavirus, and more. Brought to you in conjunction with the NatWest Group.
Hello and welcome to Saturday's edition of Coffeehouse Shots. I'm Kate Andrews. Today I'm joined by Fraser Nelson, editor of The Spectator, and Fredrik Eriksson, a Swedish economist and director of the European Centre for International Political Economy. Fraser, all the talk right now is about Europe's second wave of coronavirus. Chris Whitty, the UK's chief medical officer, has suggested that they're looking to France and Spain to see what kind of trajectory the UK could be on when it comes to a surge in our coronavirus cases. Explain to us what exactly is happening in France and Spain and how that could impact on the UK's public policy going forward.
Well, when we say Europe, Kate, you're right that we are primarily talking about France and Spain. Of all the countries in Europe, these are the two which the British government decided to use as its model for early sight of a monster which they fear is coming its way over here. And I guess it's a cautionary tale. Chris Whitty, the chief medical officer, says, look, at first they didn't care because they thought it was young people getting the infections, but now it's older people, and now, look, the deaths are starting to rise, there are more people in the hospital, and basically it's happening all over again. Now, when you look at what's happening in France, there are certainly lots of cause for concern. There's local lockdowns in Marseille and Bordeaux, and Bordeaux's got a pretty massive student population. You've got family gatherings are limited to 10 people or fewer. You're not allowed to stand in the bars anymore. Private parties and discos are banned. And the maximum number allowed to watch sporting events is cut from 1,000 to 1,000 from 5,000. By the way, pretty liberal by British standards, all of these things. But there was an interesting piece today from the Oxford Centre for Evidence-Based Medicine looking at Spain. They are arguing that the Spanish growth rates are not exponential in the way that the British fears. And if you look at Madrid, the number of cases there, certainly symptomatic cases, is now falling significantly, and in other cities in Spain as well. So this is the big question. Are we looking at a genuine rise in COVID? I think we are, certainly in Marseille and Bordeaux. But it seems to be regional. That's the funny thing about this virus. When we talk about a country, you're normally getting it wrong. Because even in Sweden, where Fredrik Eriksson is joining us from, you had a big hit in Stockholm, but in Malmö in the south, hardly any COVID at all. For reasons, by the way, I still can't begin to understand. But there is, I think, enough bad news in both Spain and France to persuade people in Britain that it's time to lock down. Meanwhile, our figures show a significant rise in the virus. But significantly, we saw the Office for National Statistics does a kind of opinion poll virus. It samples random people. And it found that all of the growth is in the under 70s. Now, that's really significant because we know that the vast majority of deaths occur in the over 70s. I think the average age of a COVID fatality in Britain is about 81 years old. So it could well be that the growth of the virus will not translate into rising hospital numbers in the same way, and it might not translate into deaths. But right now, the question is, how much do you want to risk it? How much appetite does Chris Whitty and Boris Johnson have to say, OK, let's just keep calm like the Swedes did and see if there's a hospital numbers increase? Because what they think is by the time you see that hospital increase, it's already too late, the viral horse will have bolted, and the whole thing will be coming around again.
And Fredrik, I said that all people can talk about is a European second wave, but there's a clear exception to this. If you look at the data coming from Sweden, your case numbers are actually dropping, unlike France, Spain, the UK, and Belgium, which is roughly plateaued. So when you hear that everyone else is talking about a second wave, what do you think? What is it like in Sweden? Is coronavirus still at the top of the agenda, or are there other conversations happening?
Well, I think it's fair to say that the agenda, you know, the what politicians and others talk about have changed dramatically over the past months or so. Since the parliament returned from the summer recess, now the entire focus is on crime, on gang crime, on the growth of different crime networks and clans. You had a piece in The Spectator this week by Paulina Neuding writing about this, and this has been really occupying basically all political attentions over the past couple of weeks. And of course, that's been helped by the fact that for a long period of time now, we've seen a pretty steady decline in the number of new COVID infections. We're now down to levels where, you know, it's pretty safe to say that there isn't any sort of the virus is not spreading widely in society. There may be sort of cities or parts of cities here and there that have seen sort of a bump up in the number of figures. But generally speaking, we are down to so low figures that people are beginning to return to some degree of normality in the way they behave. I mean, I think Sweden was different from many other countries already in March and April, in the sense that we tried to keep some degree of normality, but we could see from the figures and just by going out on the streets in any average Swedish city that there was a big difference between what happened after many of the recommendations came out on social distancing, working from home, and to sort of avoid going out on restaurants or bars or discos in the evenings. But now you can see buses are pretty crowded in the mornings. A lot more people are beginning to return to the offices. People that until the summer breaks, they work from home. But many companies now are coming back to some sort of rotation where a lot more people are working again. Schools opened about a month ago, and we haven't seen a spike in the number of new cases. Despite that, students return to universities, and has been sort of a number of interesting studies made pretty recently on what type of effect you could get from a lot of people returning to universities. But they basically demonstrate that this virus isn't very prevalent in Swedish society anymore.
But Fredrik, how can you be so sure that Sweden's not going to experience a bad second wave of coronavirus? It's a small country, it's a contagious virus, and perhaps it should be preparing for something worse than what happened before.
Well, it may be that there is going to be a second wave. I think it's pretty safe to say that when the winter season starts for real, and in Sweden we're not very far away from the time when it is going to start for real, we're most likely going to see an increase in the number of infections, because what we know about this virus now is that there tends to be sort of a climate effect where the spread of the virus is helped by not just people spending more time indoors, but also that the virus seems to like a climate which is a bit drier and a bit colder. Now we've been sort of in a summer period and people have been outdoors. So there will be probably going to be sort of an effect. But I think that effect is most likely going to be smaller in Sweden than elsewhere. I think what worries me a lot when I look at Britain and the rest of Europe is that we're now sort of in the beginning of September. Well, it's in the second half of September now, but the rise, the second wave started in late August and the beginning of September. And that's still a period which is, you know, pretty helpful to governments and others that are sort of taking measures to restrict the spread of the virus. But what's the situation going to be like, you know, in early December, let alone January, February?
Fraser, there's an argument that the UK is about to do in a second wave what Sweden did in the first wave. Talk of a so-called circuit break, ideas that the government's coming up with to go into semi-lockdown measures would include people still going to work and children still going to school. But it wouldn't actively encourage more social distancing. It would try to keep people away from areas where they're more likely to spread the virus. One could make the case that that's actually quite a Swedish approach the second time round. So should we be more open-minded here in the UK to these measures as they come in?
Well, I think you can certainly argue that the blaming young people has been overdone a little bit in this country, and that when you look at the Office for National Statistics figures, you think, isn't that strange? Why should there be really big rises amongst the young but no rises amongst the old? Now, perhaps it is because people are just making risk-based assessments and adjusting their behaviour accordingly. Maybe the over 70s are being a lot more cautious in how they go out and about. And maybe we are seeing, I mean, the funny thing is that we say that Sweden didn't lock down, but that's not strictly speaking true. Sweden had a kind of voluntary lockdown. Sweden said, look, and Fredrik can correct me if I'm wrong here, but the Swedish message everywhere you go around Sweden is like, please take care, keep your distance, etc. And people have been working from home quite a lot people have been working from home quite a lot in Sweden. It's just that this was done on a voluntary basis. So I think the Swedish experiment shows not that Swedes carried on as normal, but they didn't. They adjusted their behaviour quite radically, but they did so voluntarily. So this is the question over how liberal can you be here. If the government were to make its case to this country and to say, look, we're really worried about it, we don't want to force mandatory laws, but can you please adjust your behaviour in this way, and this is why we think it could help, they might get a lot better response. And indeed, this might already be happening. Because if we don't see any reason to worry about the over 70s, and we don't right now, not in any of the figures that has been released so far, then that is a fundamentally different picture to the one that we had in February and March. So in this way, it might be a bit misleading to look at the amount of the virus, the level of the virus, because it doesn't really matter how many, like, for example, one of the age groups is like between the ages of 2 and 11. The virus has been going up a lot amongst the age group in Britain. But this age group barely notices it. I think we had something like 3 deaths out of 7 million school children in this country. And all of those 3 deaths were linked to potentially other comorbidities. So there is, I think, a lot to learn by keeping your eye on France and Spain, even, and finding out, because they're not reaching for the same lockdown solutions that we are. Sweden didn't lock down for it. And I think there is a lot still to learn from other countries.
It's not terribly surprising, Frederick, that Britain is taking such a cautious approach, given that England had the highest number of excess death figures in the first wave of coronavirus, and also the biggest economic contraction of any major economy. I believe Sweden's was half that of the UK's. But Sweden does still have a major issue when it comes to the over 70s. Such a large proportion of COVID-19 deaths in Sweden were in care homes. So while it may sound strange in Sweden to hear a country debating whether or not schools can stay open, whether or not offices can stay open, Sweden is going to have to prove itself this time around when it comes to ring-fencing care homes, as it has admitted that it failed to do so, and the result of that was pretty catastrophic.
That's right, and we've actually seen this week a new recommendation coming out from the Public Health Authority that they're going to open up elderly care homes now again for outside visitors. And they do so because they believe that the care homes, the local councils that run them, or the private care homes, they have now sort of basically learned lesson from the mistakes that were done in April, May. They have now access to a lot more PPE. They have trained staff in order to know how to behave when you have COVID infections in a care home. So the directional travel right now is that the public health authority and the Swedish government seems to be pretty convinced that things have changed to such a degree in the care homes that we can start to sort of open them up for visitors again. But generally speaking, sort of the trend that has continued from the big spike in death that we saw during the spring has skewed the data even more towards very elderly people that are dying from this virus. I look at the data earlier this week, and more than 75% of all COVID-related deaths are for people above the age of 80, and virtually all of them come with one or more comorbidities. And that pattern continues to move in that direction, meaning that despite the fact that we in June, July had a good number of cases of new infections, it was mostly young people, and it didn't lead to deaths, it didn't lead to hospitalization, and sort of the people that are still dying from the virus tend to be almost exclusively very, very old people that already sort of are on the edge.
Fraser, Frederick talks about how he's tuned back into the political debates and discussions around public policy in Sweden. Next week, you're going to be stockpiling for the next round of coronavirus. These are two very different circumstances. And
sensible precautions, I would say. I'm just getting wind that this circuit breaker could be coming sooner rather than later. Okay, that's all. I will share that tidbit with our listeners.
You could say, I think quite fairly, that Sweden and the UK are on opposite sides of the spectrum when it comes to how they're handling coronavirus. That seems to be true the second time round. It was certainly true the first time round. Do you think one's clearly in the right and clearly in the wrong, or do we have something to learn from both scenarios?
We won't know who will get it right for months, perhaps even more than a year, because you need to look at, first of all, the efficacy of the measures we're using hitting the virus. I mean, even right now, the government will tell you the lockdown works, but it's been unable to say exactly how lockdown works or how effective the strategy is. And then you've got to count the costs of lockdown, not the economic costs, the human costs, the extra cancer deaths, the people who are dying at home because they're still not seeking healthcare, because they didn't seek the interventions they might have once done. So only when you can compile that ledger can you see which countries got it right and which countries didn't. And that's a funny thing. I mean, we're only, it feels like we've been living in COVID world forever, but we've only really been here for a matter of months. And when swine flu came along, it took more than a year to actually work out that this was not a novel virus. It didn't have a fatality rate higher than normal flu. But there's a huge learning curve that people needed to go on. And the amount that we don't know about our immune systems is absolutely huge. So I think all any country can do is basically take a gamble, take a bet. Sweden erred on the side of liberty. And right now, and I stress right now, Sweden looks like that bet has paid off. If Sweden were to get hit really badly by a second wave, then they might look foolish for not taking the precautions which we're taking at the moment. Similarly, if Britain's surge in infections doesn't lead to a greater surge in hospital capacity and that threatens to overwhelm it, then what we're doing now might look like an overreaction. But I would say one thing. You can only answer these questions if you look at evidence. And there has been a tendency in Britain not to look at evidence. So the learning process might be a lot slower for people who aren't particularly interested in looking very hard at evidence that suggests how these things work or not. Carl Hennigan, Oxford University, is going to be writing a piece for the website tomorrow about face masks. Now we've got months into using face masks all over Europe. What do they tell us about their use on slowing the virus? Now, he's, you know, as you might expect from somebody running the Centre for Evidence-Based Medicine, he's quite keen on using evidence to decide COVID policy.
Frederick, Sweden is on the quarantine exempt list for the UK. Will you be coming to visit?
Well, I certainly hope so, but it depends. If Britain's going to be open, there's no point going there if you are sort of on the verge of closing things again and locking down. I was actually hoping to be able to come over this autumn to watch a football game in Liverpool, but it doesn't seem that's going to happen. One thing I'd like sort of to say in the context of what Frace was talking about is that, I mean, I think Sweden has been different in another way, which is that not just the public health response or the government's response, but also the general atmosphere of the discussion we've had around coronavirus and lockdowns and restrictions over the past half year. I'd say there is sort of a different type of texture in how people react to it, basically whether people are afraid of getting the virus or not. And I think that leads to sort of a situation where Swedes aren't just judging, you know, the success or the failure of a strategy against coronavirus by the number of infections in a society or by the number of deaths that are related to COVID. There are all sorts of things, and a lot of people have been pointing to the economic consequences, and that's for sure an important element to it. I wouldn't say it's been a terribly important motivation for the government why they didn't decide to lock down. But generally speaking, I think what we're seeing now when Spain and France, Belgium and others are being pretty careful of going to sort of the nuclear option of locking down societies again is that they know that the economic consequences are going to be very drastic. They have already accumulated so many economic losses from the lockdowns that they had during the spring that it's difficult to see how they can afford it this time around. The Spanish Central Bank came out with a new forecast for the GDP drop in Spain for 2020 that added a couple of more percentage points to the drop. So it becomes difficult to sort of motivate very drastic measures given the strong economic consequences. But perhaps even more important, at least for me it's more important, is that a lot of Swedes, and I can see that when, for instance, this summer when we had a lot of foreign visitors coming to the country, that people are much more relaxed. They're not afraid of socializing with others, going out, dine out, be in areas where there are going to be a lot of other people. And I had a friend who, a foreign friend who lives here in the country, who had sort of lots of visitors from Britain coming over for the summer. And he started to call it the road to Damascus, or the Damascene conversion, when we had all these Brits coming, flying into Stockholm, you know, being prepared for almost, you know, surviving a nuclear attack with goggles, with visors, with, you know, face masks, and generally being a bit terrified of being in a country which has been classified as a rogue nation by some when it comes to our COVID defense. And then sort of after a few days, you could see just, you know, how they, you know, unbuttoned, how they sort of started to open up and made the decision for themselves that, you know, perhaps it's time to start to live a little again. And that part of it, I think it's just extraordinarily important that you can maintain a degree of not just liberty, but sort of a degree of enjoying life, despite the fact that we are in the middle of pandemic. And I think that's also something that we need to add into the broader discussion when we are comparing different policies and we're trying to understand which worked and which didn't, which countries did well and which countries didn't do well. You cannot neglect the economic consequences or the sort of the consequences on liberty and the enjoyments of life in that.
Well, on that note, we'll wish our listeners a wonderful weekend. We hope that you live a little too. Fraser, Frederick, thank you very much.